When you get tired of this, then let me know.
Oh, no, listen, do you have any time constraints?
I have, Pat, I told her I'd try to get head back out not long after 11 o'clock.
Okay.
So we got a half hour.
Okay. Just a couple other things about your career, and then I'd like to go to
sure.
this list and pick up
should.
A couple things
I think
there.
Should.
Of course, 1992 was another major change in your career when you were thrust into the limelight again after handling the dioxin and all the press coverage there. Now, all of a sudden, you really got a baptism of fire with it.
Yeah, now you're a big one.
Right. That was. But what I'd like to talk to you about with the Dow Corning affair was, again, this whole business of research and how you manage it and how you listen to what people are saying. I mean, you really came in as a troubleshooter, as it were. You weren't involved in any of that earlier,
right.
But
right.
apparently some of this goes back some years in terms of some potential difficulties. And whether or not people are listening, is this a matter of somebody pushing an idea without paying attention to some of the other detail? I don't know. I was just wondering how you reacted to that.
Well, I've asked the people who were there a little about that. And, I mean, they say some interesting things. They say, look, all over the country, women are injecting themselves with hypodermic needles and silicone gel. From all over the country, we get physicians coming to us saying, you know more about this chemistry than anybody else. This is the inert stuff. Can't you make some kind of a sack to put this stuff in so we can quit having women do this to themselves? And they make a fairly compelling argument that they felt an obligation to be in this business because they convinced themselves that these things were important for women. And if they didn't have them, they're going to do something that was pretty stupid. And then they'd go on to say, and we thought we might build a pretty good business about this, recognizing we're going to make much money with this, we might make a bunch of money in the medical business. I mean, that's, I've oversimplified, but that's in essence what I heard people say. I think one could say you want to be very careful if you've grown up in an industrial chemical environment, suddenly making products for human implantation, direct use, whatever, because, at least in today's world, it was a little different then because all these things were kind of grandfathered and these were devices, not products, and all that stuff. In today's world, you know, you need to have some pretty sophisticated kind of capabilities to even consider being in that stuff. I don't think Dow Corning had them, nor really knew what was required, and the FDA wasn't requiring much. And they thought they were doing something to help a lot of people who otherwise might hurt themselves. But I would have to... It's not possible for me to judge, I don't think, the level or the quality of the research done at that time in the context of that time. I would have to say today I wish some of that had been more indifferent. But I'd be reluctant to judge it then. If you ask me the fundamental question, was that a smart business for Dow Corning to be in? That answer is easy, and the answer is no. And I said that way before this controversy came along, just on its merits. I mean, I don't think we have to make any money with this. I don't think that's the best use of our resources. I mean, on the three criteria that I gave you before, it didn't cut it. So that was always an easy judgment for me. And I felt that way and have said so way before I ever got involved with Dow Corning.
Did you... how shall I phrase this? How were you received at Dow Corning?
Yeah, they were ready for the white knight. They were ready. I mean, I would say to you that Dow Corning had the reaction any of us have, and that's kind of the sea anemone reaction when something pokes it, you know, it balls up and puts the spines out. And... my approach was quite different, and that one wasn't working. So I was And I wondered if people would say, oh boy, here's, you know, here's Big Brother thrusting one of their own in here to tell us what we're doing wrong or whatever. I wondered about that a little bit, but the situation was difficult enough, and the need for somebody to be decisive, count on anything, was great enough that that was just not a factor. Not a factor, I think. I doubt if, well, you might find one. You might, out of the 7,000 people there, you might find one or two just soon I hadn't shown up. But you'd find 6,998 that would say that was a good deal, I think. Mm-hmm. My nature is, I could have had more trouble, I think, if I'd gone over there and closeted myself, you know, in some room and started issuing proclamations. But that's not my style or nature. I'm out there talking to everybody, finding out what the hell's going on, and asking for opinions, and being very decisive about judgments. And no problem.
How did you react to that assignment? I mean, here you were essentially winding down at Dow. You talked about taking this early retirement and so on, and your road was clear to going back to Oregon. And
yeah, I talked with Ned about that a little, and you'll see it in there, I guess. It was a very painful decision for me. It was a painful decision, which I would not have made had I not been asked. In the context of it, is Dow asking me to do this. No individual would I have done that for. But I have an old-fashioned view of loyalty and obligation, and I mean, it sounds corny, and I can't help it. That's what, from a personal standpoint, it was. I mean, you know, I've been through lung cancer and worked for 35 years kind of without taking a break, and I had the break all lined up, had the house bought here, had everything kind of done. And I mean, I knew that was not going to be an easy deal, so I didn't want to do that very badly. But once having agreed to do it, I mean I gave it everything I felt I knew how to, so it was okay. But it was not. I did not seek that office, I guess it would be fair to say that.
One of the things you knew was that you were going to be in the national spotlight.
Sure, absolutely knew.
I mean, that, and in today's world, that's such a glaring spotlight.
Yeah, it was pretty dramatic. I. As you probably read, I did a Larry King show 8 days or 10 days or something after getting my job, after being at Dow Corning. And everybody said, how could you possibly do that? I would tell you, it's a lot better to do it after 8 days than it is after 45, because you don't have to know everything after 8 days. And, but it was pretty interesting. I mean, I doubt if in American industry there are more than a half dozen people who, maybe Burke had it when Tylenol had it, but there aren't very many people who had that level of attention, probably. And I don't say that with great pride and enthusiasm, it's just the way it was. It was big stuff.
Let me ask you just a general media question.
Sure.
How did you find the media in terms of, you know, hidden agendas or the prejudices already in place?
I would say, I mean, I have no way of knowing how many media people I talked to. I would pick a number, a couple hundred maybe, some number like that. There is only one instance out of all of those that I perceive to be biased and not entirely fair. I mean, I will tell you that, I mean, my approach to them was, look, you got a job and I got a job. The thing that had happened is you'd get 50 calls in an hour. Well, you can't possibly respond to 50 calls in an hour. So what I'd say to them is, look, I got to prioritize this stuff. Don't kid me now. Tell me when your deadline is. Tell me when I must call you. And somehow I'll get that done. And then I can sort them out. You know? And our reaction to that was, Well, nobody ever asked us about our problem before, you know. I mean, we always say we got to talk to you now, even though our deadline's midnight, because otherwise we'll never get you. And nobody ever thought about that. And so, but I get to see, and I always, I mean, I've never missed one, I don't believe, in all that time. So I kind of set a good tone with them. And of course, everybody knew I was, I mean, no, nobody could ask me the how did you ever let this happen kind of question, right? So the questions for me were, what are you going to do about it? I was kind of ready for those. So I don't, with just one exception, will tell you that I was never treated, in my opinion, unfairly or improperly by the press. I mean, they ask hard questions and tough questions and sometimes even mean questions, but I always believed that was kind of their job. And I tried hard to tell them when I didn't know something that I didn't know it. And I was, you know, I mean, it was a pretty professional relationship. And I have admiration for them. They did good.
That's good. It's good to know.
Yeah, no, I know I'm a minority who generally feels that way, but that's how I felt.
Well, let's, we've covered a good number of these items on my agenda.
I'll highlight a couple of them that are interesting to you. You can tell by now I don't know much, but I have no problem talking.
Oh, no, listen, it's been great. Let's go down here towards the bottom. What is important for the future vitality of chemical innovation?
Yeah. It's a very interesting subject. I think about it. I mean, you get this question, well, has everything important been discovered? Are all the big products already out there? I mentioned earlier to you today, everybody wanted to work on advanced plastic material. Now today, most of those are pulling in their horns and they're all kind of come back, and what's big? It's polystyrene and polyethylene and all of that, you know? So now you're a researcher and you're trying to find something that will be relevant to a $20 billion chemical enterprise. And research is very expensive. I mean, here's a Dow spending, I don't know, pick a number, $1.2 billion a year or something on research. And you got to earn a big return on that and make it matter for a $20 billion company. What's that going to be? That's hard. And it makes the job of research management difficult and frustrating, because the financial guys are always saying to you, hell, I'd be better off taking your damn research budget and putting it in the bank and earning 10%. At least I'd have $120 million a year or something in profit instead of this big loss that I get every year. And not only that, I get my money back from the bank when I'm through. You guys, it's gone. And that complicates the innovative process, I think, a little bit. You know, I mean, so you put that there, and then you say, well, wait a minute, though. Here comes a guy named Bill Gates who figured out some half-assed way to make a program to make a computer work, and he's the richest man in the world, and he did all that in 15 years. Don't tell me there's no room for innovation. And where I come out on all that now, to kind of answer your question, I think there is lots of room for innovation in chemistry and chemical technology. The particular area that seems to me to just have immense promise going forward, at least from what I can see now, is this area of bioengineering and bio. I hate to use the word biotech because it's an overused word, but as we understand more and more about the human genome, and which genes do what stuff, and what changes them. I mean, it just, and I take all that, and then I look at the demographics of the quality of people, what people are ready to pay for the quality of life, the demographics that everybody's living longer anyway. And I say to myself, just from a commercial context, let alone from a social and humanitarian, boy, there's a lot there. And it goes beyond just disease. For example, here I am talking to you. What are the chemical changes in my body that are occurring that cause me to talk to you or to think about what I'm going to say to you, or for that matter, what to make my jaws move? a lot of stuff there not well understood, and that's not rail cars or polystyrene. It might be milligrams or something, but oh, are those going to be valuable milligrams? I mean, I think all that's changing. And at the same time, there are still some very fundamental things in the rail car arena. I mean, nobody has yet figured out how to directly oxidize propylene to make propylene oxide. If you and I did that this afternoon, we could buy Arizona. So, I think the horse is alive and well. Although I hear some folks kind of every once in a while say the horse is dead. Like the patent guy in 1856 who said everything's been pretty much invented. Well, I think this is 1856 for the chemical business. I think there's lots there.
What do you see, though? You've commented about how much Dow spends on research.
Yeah.
And my impression is that a lot of places, either the research budget has gone down or it's more short-term oriented. And there's very little in terms of long-term.
Comes from this pressure on on profitability, on financial performance, allegedly productivity. I have, you know, you get into some pretty interesting arguments about how productive you can make, how efficient is maybe a better, you can make research. Because, you know, you slick it up and trim it up and have everybody have their little time card so they're always at the bench instead of thinking and looking off and dreaming. You get into interesting things about where what's efficient and what's productive there. I think, and again, I don't have as broad an experience as I'd like to be able to draw on here, but I have to say this, and it'll come across fairly critical, I think, in this interview, but I want to say it anyway. I believe industrial research has been significantly less productive than it might have been or should have been. And at least part of that is because it has been unnecessarily inefficient. Not all, but part. And I think of all of the management functions, management skills that are important in large chemical enterprises, the one I would tell you that's least developed is research management. I have met a zillion managers, research managers, general managers, chief executive officers, marketing managers, and if somebody said to me, okay, forget the discipline, just pick me the top 20 of the people, of all the people you've met, just for their inherent competence and ability to do what they do, I don't think any of them would be research managers. Not one. Not one. See, that's a bad deal. That's a bad deal. Why is that? I don't know quite why is that. I mean, I think you could make an argument that somebody who has spent his career learning how to be a brilliant researcher is unlikely to be a brilliant research manager and probably shouldn't be wasting his time doing that. People who aren't going to have the skills to become a great researcher probably don't start in it. And you can't be a great research manager without understanding a fair amount about research. So there's kind of a narrow cut there that is the raw material base. Does that make sense? I mean, you understand what I'm saying there? I think that's a little bit of the problem. You try to take a director of marketing at age 50 and have him be director of research, you're dead in the water. You can't do that. If you take a PhD chemist who's been 40 years at the bench and have him be that, you got to be lucky for them to be good. And there isn't a cadre of raw material. That's one problem. The second one that has always been an amazing thing to me, if I look at the top 100 highly paid people in a typical chemical company, I don't think I get to a research chemist. Mm. Top 100, not top 5. Top 100, I don't think I get to a research chemist. at least not anybody doing research. I might conceivably get to the director of research and development, who's a research manager, all right, somewhere up in there. And, I mean, I can find marketing executives, and I can find people running regions, geography people. I can find all that stuff. People running manufacturing plants, you know, I can find all that stuff. But here's this group of individuals whose inventions drive all that other stuff. Drive on. Now, they got to have all these other people to make them turn into a reality. But without the seed corn, nobody grows corn. And for years, I have kind of fought the system that defines the size and value of those jobs. A lot of people don't report to them. They don't have big capital budgets, all those things that go into what you should get paid for. You know, they can get 100% on intuition, but if that's only 10% of the total, you know, and so if I'm a brilliant young manager, I mean, if I was infinitely smart and it was square one, I would decide what I was going to be a manager of, and I could be the greatest research manager that ever lived, I probably still wouldn't go do that. Because I ain't going to get pump-off job doing that. See? So I worry about that, and here's a chance for me to kind of get that on the record somewhere, just some little guy out here in Arizona. But if I had it to all start over again and I had my own great big chemical company, I'd, by God, fix that. I would develop myself some professional research managers, starting at an early age. Possible to do that. When I was at Dow and got the communications function, we had no communications training ladder, no nothing like that. And what we did is hire a bunch of slide rules and teach them how to type, basically. And I said, God damn, guys, let's hire some typewriters and teach them how to run slide rules here. We need professional typewriters. I think maybe we need some professional research managers. We might even have to go our own to do that. But I'd tackle that. That's something I think's been amiss, and I think it's led to some of this lack of productivity and effectiveness. I mean, it struck me when I was briefly director of research and development for Dow. It strikes me to this day as remarkable how much feeling came to me from the research community because I had that job and the way I did it. I mean, I got plaques and I get letters and I'm getting invited every year to stuff, you know. And the research managers who kind of went all the way through that, some reason or other, didn't ever happen to. I know Pruitt's got a building named after him and all that other stuff, but I'm just telling you, in the same context, it ain't the same. And I worry about that. My only experience is Dow experience. At least my only in-depth. But I listen to folks and talk to folks in other outfits, and I get a very similar kind of a thing. So, something to think about.
That's great. That's very good. I think our time may be just about up.
Yeah, we're in pain here.
Anything else you'd like to add at this point?
No, I don't think so. You got that long thing I did with Ned
right.
For the Dow side of that. You might, if you haven't seen it, just somewhere get the essence of what I said at that metal dinner. I mean, I really only said two things at that metal dinner. Let me just get them on the record here. One of them was, we in this industry, we've taken a lot of hits. We've done some things wrong. We aren't perfect. We were pretty defensive for a long time, you know. But we're in a business of working with some complicated and sometimes toxic materials, and once in a while something isn't the way we'd like it to be there. Recognizing that and saying it, then I say to you, if our objectives beyond the earth are quality and longevity of life, that's kind of the two things, to have a good life and to have it last a while, then I believe this discipline and this technology have done more for that than any other anywhere, period. And I really do believe that. I mean, I don't think you can pick any aspect of social behavior today or of society. I mean, transfer, fundamental stuff, clothing, food, transport, all that. And you look at where they'd be without the advances in this technology, and I'll tell you, you know, this is the one. So I hope we kind of remember that as we talk about all the tribulations, that when somebody says to me, I think all the discoveries are done and the party's over, I say, read what that guy said in the patent office in 1856, man, you are smoking pot here. And I want to get down. So that's, I guess, my last salvo.
Thank you very much for spending the morning with me. I enjoyed it too.
We have an afternoon for you. You can go out and bask around and see.
It's a beautiful day.
See, yeah, this is a nice day. You picked a good time to be here. And I appreciate your coming.
Thank you.